caught in the dark with the radio spark. Meet me where the most light falls. You're listening to Where the Most Light Falls with DJ Tamara on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more. Hello and welcome to Where the Most Light Falls. Happy New Year. I'm Tamara Miles, your host for this audio literary journal, and I call myself a voice for poets. You can find my poetry page at Facebook at tamaramiles.poet and on Twitter at tamaramilessc. I also have a website called Sylvia's Daughter Says at wix.com, so you can find out more about me there if you're interested. But the show isn't about me as much as it is about you and other poets and writers out there in the discovered and undiscovered country. Today's background music is an album by Brian Crane. I believe you'll enjoy it, so let me get it started for you now. This is Piano and Cello Duet. I'd like to begin today's session with a piece of microfiction or flash fiction by my friend Tim Jones. It's called Nothing Happens. The old man sat watching the TV from his favorite armchair. He sat there for up to 18 hours a day, mostly watching the news channel and being annoyed. It was the same stories every hour, but he had to keep watching in case something happened. But nothing happened. He turned off the TV just as a car crashed through the window of his living room, spraying splinters of window frame and shards of glass all over his favorite armchair. Wow, you never know what will happen when you are sitting in your own living room. Pull up a chair and sit with me, and we'll see what happens here today. I'll tell you more about Tim Jones in a minute. He's a character. My goal for this show is to celebrate poets and writers at all different stages, so some of the names and works you'll hear may be familiar to you. I will draw from well-known and lesser-known literary journals and from the works of my friends and fellow writers in my online creativity group called the Curiosity Salon. If you would like to join us, you'll find us under that name on Facebook. If you've never been in a creativity group, let me read what one of our members, Mark Burns, wrote after an especially rewarding day spent in one of our free online creativity boot camps. This was back when Jane Berry was still running the salon and the boot camps, and we owe a great deal to her. She's an Irish writer. She has a novel coming out soon, and I'd love for you to learn about it. You can check her out at that curious love of green. She keeps a regular blog related to her writings and her creativity coaching and her fashion and everything else that she's interested in. Remarkable woman. All right, here's what Mark wrote after being in one of the boot camps. The words written here today have me spinning, amazed, aroused. I bow. I say thank you. I wonder what time the next train is, the next boat. I order vaccinations. I watch a blood spot appear on my forearm from the needle. I stagger delirious from this overdose. I don't know where I am, but I want to leave. I want to burrow and hide and put these words under my pillow. I wonder where I left my tin opener. I see sunrises from Venus. I want to go 7 rounds with Sonny Liston. I want to get sunburned in Arizona and feel someone peel off the flaking skin with her purple painted fingernails. I want to burn down a hay barn in Andalusia and throw rotten eggs at an old balding priest. I want to skate naked across a frozen lake in Minnesota. I want to ride a bicycle to Bordeaux and eat snail's legs cross-legged beneath the willow tree. I want to feel how a record by the Jesus and Mary chain sounds. I want to roll up a beautiful, laughing woman in an ancient Persian rug and carry her over my shoulder until tomorrow. And with these words shared here today, I have done these things. Thank you. You are magnificent. Writing is easy, said someone or other. All you have to do is sit at your typewriter and bleed. I've done a little of that this boot camp, trying to top out on the mission statement that Jane provoked us to claiming. I wrote that I wanted to write one true sentence. I'm a good bit closer. Mark is a Northern Irish poet and writer whose work related to music and the arts has been published in a variety of magazines and journals in Ireland and in our own special poetry journal in Columbia, South Carolina, called Fall Lines. He is also an occasional radio show host in Derry. When I talk about myself, I sometimes feel awkward. How about you? I've been reading some good bios, like Mark's and other authors and friends of mine. Tim Jones, for instance, who writes in a variety of genres, including his flash fiction, but also he writes nonfiction and he's written a novel. I also like to call Tim a ukulele visionary because he does play that wonderful instrument and write about his adventures. In addition, he is a radio show host also. This bio of his is from an interview article published in Short Story and Flash Fiction Society newsletter. After the bio, I'll share some of the interview. Tim Jones writes and writes and writes and writes. He has written hundreds of flash fiction stories, scores of short stories, and has recently finished his first full-length novel. His computer is crammed full of Word documents containing unfinished stories he hopes to complete one day. Despite the dark themes present in a lot of his stories, Tim is actually very well balanced and is not a maniac at all. Oh, it's a wonderful bio, isn't it? Here's his response to the interview question, "Why did you choose flash fiction?" I wasn't even aware of the term flash fiction when I started writing it. I'd been attempting to write short stories for a few years, but I was struggling to complete any of them. Some friends at a book group I used to go to suggested we have a short story competition of sorts, and after much debate over what the word count should be, somebody suggested 100 words. I wrote one that very evening, and then wrote a couple more. And that's when I got the idea for my first book, 100 by 100. I never thought I would manage to write 100 stories of any length, and it was quite an achievement for me to accomplish, being that I was the writer without a full story to his name before that. You can find Tim Jones at flashfictiondaily.blogspot.co.uk and elsewhere on the wide web, or perhaps at your local pub. I've shared with you before some ekphrasis pieces, writing that responds to paintings or other forms of art. I'd like to begin with one of those today, and then invite you to write your own ekphrasis and send it to me at TamaraMilesSC@gmail.com or to any of the social media addresses I have provided today. This poem is in response to Van Gogh's Thatched Houses at Cordville. Storybook roof, 20 years thatched in whistled snatches of a worker's time. Belt slung, tool-tongued, he climbs upon the ladder rungs. His hammer beats the bundled straw by nail to paper laths pitched high and steep to tame the rainfall's rolling, lulling rhyme when underneath a mother reads, having sung her tot to sleep. Pick a painting or a sculpture or anything else, any other work of art that catches your fancy, and write in response to it. It doesn't have to be a poem. It can be a piece of flash fiction. It can be an essay. It can be just a few paragraphs, nonfiction, fiction. It doesn't matter. I'd love to read your work and consider it for reading on the radio show. TamaraMilesSC@gmail.com. Now, I'd like to introduce a new segment of the show in which I'm going to be featuring some more in-depth poetry analysis. And I'll begin today with a part of a paper that I wrote called Public and Private Persona in Richard Corey and in Barbie Doll. Richard Corey is a poem by Edwin Arlington Robinson, and I'll read that to you now. Whenever Richard Corey went downtown, we people on the pavement looked at him. He was a gentleman from sole to crown, clean-favored and imperially slim. And he was always quietly arrayed, and he was always human when he talked. But still, he fluttered pulses when he said, "Good morning," and he glittered when he walked. And he was rich, yes, richer than a king, and admirably schooled in every grace. In fine, we thought that he was everything to make us wish that we were in his place. So on we worked and waited for the light and went without the meat and cursed the bread. And Richard Corey, one calm summer night, went home and put a bullet through his head. I found this poem online at the Poetry Foundation. The Poetry Foundation is the publisher of Poetry Magazine. It's an independent literary organization committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in our culture. I'm reading directly from the website. It exists to discover and celebrate the best poetry and to place it before the largest possible audience. The Poetry Foundation works to raise poetry to a more visible and influential position in our culture. Rather than celebrating the status quo, the Foundation seeks to be a leader in shaping a receptive climate for poetry by developing new audiences, creating new avenues for delivery, and encouraging new kinds of poetry. The second poem that I mentioned is Barbie Doll by Marge Piercy. And I'll read that one to you now. This girl child was born as usual and presented dolls that did pee-pee and miniature GE stoves and irons and wee lipsticks the color of cherry candy. Then, in the magic of puberty, a classmate said, "You have a great big nose and fat legs." She was healthy, tested intelligent, possessed strong arms and back, abundant sexual drive and manual dexterity. She went to and fro, apologizing. Everyone saw a fat nose on thick legs. She was advised to play coy, exhorted to come on hardy, exercise, diet, smile, and wheedle. Her good nature wore out like a fan belt. So she cut off her nose and her legs and offered them up. In the casket, displayed on satin, she lay with the undertaker's cosmetics painted on. A turned-up, putty nose, dressed in a pink and white nighty. "Doesn't she look pretty?" everyone said. Consummation at last. To every woman, a happy ending. In an article published 45 years after Barbie Doll was published in 1971, Marge Piercy offered her thoughts on whether her perspectives have changed. She says, "What has not improved since 1971 is the importance society, men and women themselves, place on body image. In fact, it's gotten worse. The media is incredibly important. We are in a time when people spend hours a day pursuing a perfect body, far more narrowly defined than ever before. Marilyn Monroe had a woman's body. Now she would be put on a severe diet in order to have liposuction. We are as puritanical about food and weight as previous generations were about sex. Fat is seen as a sign of weakness, indulgence, sin. Flesh is bad, bones are good. Girls diet themselves into anorexia in order not to become women, but to keep a little girl's curveless body. We discarded those torturous girdles only to welcome Spanx. A woman's natural body that has been admired for thousands of years is now gross. To age is just as bad. It takes an enormous amount of time and money to try to always look younger than you are and carry less weight than your body comfortably wants to carry. Women may now become doctors, lawyers, judges, senators, governors, the presidents of co-ed colleges. But we are still judged, first, by how we look, and second, by how we dress. Attacks on Hillary Clinton when she was running for president almost always included denigration of her appearance. Women who can afford it court danger by going under the knife to correct what they perceive as flaws. Breasts too small, too large, too droopy. Vagina not tight enough, nose too big or long, fat around the hips or belly or thighs, chin too sharp, too weak, too square. It's rare to find a woman who accepts her body as it is, who likes herself in that way, or sometimes in any way at all. We are not beings, but projects, always under construction or deconstruction. We are not always aware of the private pain that people endure. And we are not always aware of the pain that we can cause other people with our words and our judgments. What we've said can stay in someone's mind and spread into a collection of hurts that causes long-term emotional damage. If you've been bullied or misunderstood, as Marge Piercy has described in her poem, Barbie Doll, you know what I'm talking about. Here are my thoughts about these two poems as expressed in a paper that I wrote called On the Outside Looking In, Public and Private Persona in Richard Corey and Barbie Doll. Edwin Arlington Robinson's Richard Corey and Marge Piercy's Barbie Doll present painful accounts of misunderstood lives. Two individuals, as they are perceived and evaluated by outsiders as compared to the reality of their private experiences. The character Richard Corey and the unnamed girl child of Piercy's poem are more complex than people know, and they both struggle with desperation and despair. The lessons in these poems are not so much moralistic as they are revelatory. That is, they reveal the chasm between public perception and the secrets held closely by individuals. That said, the poems do clearly provide an opportunity for readers to examine their own attitudes, insensitivities, and even cruelties toward others. Perhaps the insensitivities are due to ignorance. Perhaps people do not realize the extent of their cruelties or the consequences that may result from them. However, Robinson and Piercy do not let these errors go without commentary. Each poem indirectly encourages greater empathy for those we encounter, though they may be strangers. I'd like to hear your thoughts on either or both of these poems. You can send them to me at my email address, TamaraMilesSC@gmail.com, or via Facebook at TamaraMiles.poet, or even at Twitter through direct message. It's at TamaraMilesSC. Sometimes when I write a poem, especially one of my Earth Gospel poems, it turns out to be about more than I intended. More than a poem about nature, it calls to something powerful in us. Let me give you an example with a poem I wrote this week called Reindeer Moss. In this poem, I recall Robert Frost's lines about how fire or ice would do equally well to end our world. Reindeer moss. Cladonia rangiferina. Reindeer moss, a lichen, food for heavy Arctic animals who fuss beneath snow to find it. Pastoral, multiple branched, it feathers low across a landscape, determined, gray-green or off-white, both fungus and algae. A symbiotic pairing, and does not succumb to biting cold. In warmer climates, when fire creeps in, it is fed and gingered by the moss it lays claim to until flames leap and spread. To the Russian reindeer herder, its antler-like appearance means food is near, and with it, sustenance. In Yamal, when an ice crust prevents reindeer from getting to the moss, their carcasses lie far and wide on the tundra as witnesses to its significance. The reindeer fall from hunger, go to sleep, and lie vulnerable to predators. Rootless, then, perhaps 4 inches high, an organism that can live on dew determines the life force of the mighty. A natural idea in politics, those above should tremble, lest the ice between us make them weak, their legs buckle and at last collapse. And if fire touches us, we will bear it on our backs until it is pitched to every corner of this landscape, and every mouth becomes a flamethrower. Here's another Ekphrasis poem. It's called Plains That Pass Me Over. Plains that pass me over. Plains that somehow land. Plains that guide and plains that hide, mysterious. All drift in dreams here to the small scratched compass in my hand. I drink. Sometimes I drive north down private lanes, find a shed behind a grand facade and tuck myself inside. I am alternately fine or furious, on the best days merely scared or curious. I hear a plane, its engine choir. In my heart, its wings are featherweight, but how they flutter. The lion with me on his stool awaits the whip. Then he will leap through a golden hoop of fire. My desire this, to go a-flying as I hold on to his mane. Let's have another winter poem. This one by my friend and a member of the Curiosity Salon, Christine Tabaka. The poem is called Winter Garden. Saturday morning, silence broken only by the wren's scolding trill. Cherry blossoms bloom no more. Ice stares down the last ray of hope. Trees shake off day-old snow from barren limbs. Winter garden dry, brown, dead, but not dead, merely asleep. Hibernation mode. The snow, the feel, the sound. Seasons march their pace. They cannot be rushed. Wait, we must. Rejoice in nature's wisdom. There is no other path. Anne Christine Tabaka is a nominee for the 2017 Pushcart Prize in Poetry. She lives in Delaware. She's a published poet and artist who loves gardening and cooking. She lives with her husband and two cats. Her most recent credits include Page and Spine, The Paragon Journal, The Literary Hatchet, The Stray Branch, Triggerfish Critical Review, Foliant Oak Review, and several others. The poem that I read to you was published in Poetry Breakfast, and Poetry Breakfast accepts submissions of poetry and poetry-related creative nonfiction year-round. Another friend and member of the Curiosity Salon, Marichit Garcia, has a new project going on that I want to tell you about. It's called simply Stories, and you can find it at her website, The Impossible Garden, at www.marichitgarcia.com/blog/introducing-stories. Her name is spelled M-A-R-I-C-H-I-T. G-A-R-C-I-A, Marichit Garcia. Here's what she says about her stories. Stories are what happen in the impossible garden and the wild forest. They are the overheard conversations, the gossip of the flowers and the trees, the fragments written on bones and stones. They are the secrets whispered by the wind, the tales of the stars, the knowledge earned or traded with the forest dwellers. They are the fairy tales that have been forgotten or never told. They are the rules and the history and how they are repeatedly broken and rewritten. They are the murmurings of magic, the language of hidden love, the wildness beneath every order and the pattern beneath every chaos. They are truths and they are lies, and in the end, they are real to those who have the heart to see. At the end of her introduction to the stories, Marichit says, "Read on at the risk of believing in magic and the impossible. May you find favor among the odd." I'm one of the odd ones, and I take pride in it. How about you? It's nice when other people can share some of my odd interest and even publish one of my poems. I'd like to say a special thank you to the editors at Thistle Magazine who published my poem, The Whale Evangelist, in this last issue. I am honored to be included. I'm reading from the website this note. The Thistle team, Aaron, Genevieve, Jean, Tao, Amoka, and Katie take a bow after our final performance. Our featured writer section returns with Greg Bashar, plus interviews with Layla Akbar, Christy Lopez, and Francis accompany your musical submissions. We're sad to see the last issue of Thistle Magazine, but it was a beautiful send-off, and I'm grateful to have the Whale Evangelist included. This is a poem that I didn't know whether it would ever find a home. It took a while. Here it is. The Whale Evangelist. In 1970, humpback whales produced their first gold record, Antiphonal, a spiritual experience. Greenpeace took the mysterious sirens out to sea on loudspeakers to fall like prophecy on whaling vessel crewmen, momentarily stunned and silent before they carried on with the slaughter. The songs are patterns of pulse and play, melody and echo, call and response. The whale evangelist swoons us with his sermon love song, and in a sedated chorus, revolving around a turntable on the axis of the world, we hum up a holy being from the right parietal lobe, pew of the brain's God spot, lit with spindle neurons. Surprise! A humpback's cerebral cortex, too, contains these neurons. If for some Sunday morning sun worship service at the beach, once sand soothed and murmuring to ourselves that we are safe and good, we should stroll into the ocean sanctuary, put our heads one by one underwater, and surrender to the great prophet's sacred song. If we should be baptized in the sounds of his belly for 3 days, and then spit out on the shore, stinking but sanctified, we may at long last become both more godlike and more human, and make love, not war, with our religion. We'll have a little break now and just listen to the music. And I encourage you to do some journaling, creative writing, or whatever else is on your mind. But use this time. Take out some pencil and paper. Get on your Microsoft Word. Do a little writing. And if something magic happens, I'd love to read what you've got. And consider reading it on the radio. So send it to me at Tamara Miles, TamaraMiles, @gmail.com. And I'll give you a few minutes to write. Okay, I hope you'll continue writing. I'm going to go back to talking about beautiful literature. And one of my favorite recent pieces is by my friend Catherine O'Sullivan. Catherine's an Irish woman from Limerick. And she, like many other of us, was saddened by the news that Dolores, the lead singer of the Cranberries, had passed away this week. She, my friend Catherine, wrote this piece called Limerick, She Lingers. And she published it at her blog, viewfromzanymountain.wordpress.com. And I'd like to share with you this post. I haven't been in Dublin since last Tuesday night. Well, I have been in Dublin physically, but in my head I've been in Limerick, circa 1993. Nostalgia is an exquisite thing, isn't it? The balance between happiness, longing, and the painful realization of the passing of time. I went to UL in the early 90s. It was a small enough place, as Limerick City is itself, and everyone knew everyone. Our haunt was the stables, especially on Thursday nights. We wore woolly jumpers and docks, lived on a diet of chicken curries, pints of Carling, silk-cut fags, and lobster pot prawn cocktail chips. Now there is a longing. The stables bar was the actual center of our universe. It's where I met Mr. ZM and my best friend of all times, who I never really forgave for fecking off to America. Just joking, eh? It's where the Euro studs, as us funny humanities crowd in a sea of engineers were known, used to gather and discuss the issues of the day, or rather, gossip. It was also the place when, in 1993, an unknown Limerick band called the Cranberries used to have a regular Thursday night gig. When I first saw the Cranberries, I was pretty staggered. Front woman Dolores had such an amazing, haunting, almost ethereal voice. She was shy, too, you could tell, but somehow her tiny frame and beauty took up the stage. I remember one night her getting off the stage and having a chat with some of us. Of course, we never realized they would go on to be such global superstars back then. To us, they were a local Limerick band, one of us who played in the stables. Looking back now, it was such a privilege to have seen them live in such an intimate setting. Limerick is a funny place, really. A place that I can get defensive about because, despite the image, it is a place where people are tough and somehow bonded and extrovert and humorous and fiercely, fiercely proud. And that was Dolores for you. She never lost her accent or the pride for her County Limerick roots. Ever. When I heard about her untimely passing while I was commuting home, I must admit, in an uncharacteristic fashion, I turned my head to the window and cried silently as the memories flooded back. The biggest compliment a County Limerick person can pay another person is to say, fair play. So I would like to say, fair play to you, Dolores. Your star will shine brightly over Limerick forever. Thank you, Catherine. I'd like to share a couple of pieces from the Feminine Collective, a wonderful online journal. As it sounds from the title, Feminine Collective, it is powered by and features marvelous women. If you look at the website right now on the front cover, there's a piece called The Warriors by Julie Anderson and a picture of some women marching, saying, "We won't give up and we won't give in." I was honored to have some of my poems published by the Feminine Collective recently. But first, before I share those poems, I'd like to read The Warriors by Julie Anderson. time, a robber disguised rubbed the edges of her tenant, eroding the pillars of confidence that she adhered to, ones that she constantly held against daily attacks on her spirit. She is naked while dreaming. She is naked, living in a land of it never was this way before. She is naked while fighting. Her war cry can be heard from behind closed doors. Still no relief. Secret truths blasted wide open because she was brave. No matter what he said, defiant against his aggression, strong conviction holding fast her shield, she is a warrior. She fights on behalf of her unrealized desires and her daughter's dreams, all of them saved. They are the bullets that she carries in her heart. Her foes didn't see her coming down one by one. Watch me. The time has come. She knows that her most powerful weapon is one forged with fury, indestructible because of its two components, truth and unwavering courage. She must also remember the stories, the ones that are written in the forever book of time, and ones from the ongoing battles of her story and history. With the global wails of No and Me Too ringing in her ears, she shields herself from the opposition by standing next to equality for all. The time has come. With the power of collective thought, they have vowed allegiance to this new way of living, being decent. They face a ring of fire. The cumulative war cry rattled the oaks of biased behavior that are rooted in hate, watered with violence. A battalion of souls who want peace and who live with reverence in their hearts stepped up and forward, ready to stand firm on the basis of morality. Their silent screams conveyed loud enough to incinerate the enduring negative voices, messages, actions, and violence. Exposed after the fire, among the shattered glass, heads silently rolled down halls, the unthinkable happened. No longer will positions of power be held by coddled assailants. No longer will societal bias be the driving force behind all decisions. No longer will anyone be considered less than. The time has come. Watch me. The time is now. A marvelous piece. Julie Anderson is the creator and publisher of Feminine Collective. She was inspired to create this safe place for women to share their secrets, desires, triumphs, and pain as the antithesis of what mainstream media offers women today. In her column, Pursuit of Perfection, she explores the importance of rectifying the balance of inner and outer beauty through essays, poems, and articles on self-esteem, shame, family, and self-acceptance. I've just read her bio from the Feminine Collective, and you can go and read more about her and read more of her work at the website femininecollective.com. Now I'll go back a month or so, 6 weeks or so, and find a couple of poems that the Feminine Collective published of mine. These poems were a little risky for me. They were, frankly, one of them sexual in nature, and the other was built on a spiritual idea. It had to do with Jesus Christ and what I see as an apocryphal vision of Christ. So I'll read those two for you now. The first one is called Tinge. This then will cure me. No, not that. An edge of knife blade, self-turned to pinch at wrist, not slice, just tip in to test resolve, not once, twice to be certain. I am too much coward for whip wounds, self-inflicted scourges. This too requires courage. Wind whipping at bare throat, sleeveless, tongue to ice, burn, braver than most. Cauterized at the raw stitch, always, always the stubborn yearn, a year-long sigh, witch's wish, itch, fingers finally relenting to self-touch, to moan, to rise, to cry. To fall and all in too soon, repetition, a turning record, an elegant scratching slide, scratch, slide, needle, at this lover, at this parting, widening river, reaching its own mouth. The second poem was called Apocrypha. And when I wrote this one, I really did worry that if my extended family read it, they might be offended. But I mean what it says. I think it's more spiritual maybe than many of the things that I've written up to this point. Apocrypha. Jesus beat the bullies back from the temple and wiped his brow. He hadn't signed on for this. He counted the days until retirement, which amounted to 70 times 7. There was a backlog of bribes and bitter confessions, and the overtime was killing him. He threw the first stone. It skipped across the Jordan, flung itself back in a slingshot, and hit him on the forehead as he wrote in the sand a poem about forgiveness with his own blood. And frankly, this was his plan all along. He did not want to be a giant. He wanted to be an artist. If they sent him downrange, he would go AWOL. He had never approved of violence. He would stage a sit-in at the left hand of God, whose fingers made a permanent peace sign. To the woman who touched his garment, he said, "Sister, you have always been whole. Take up your protest signs and march. Chant, and the door will be opened to you." I'm grateful to the Feminine Collective for sharing my work. I encourage you to submit something. Now, I'd like to head over to the Cynical Journal. The Cynical is published by my friend and radio guru, Raymond Szilard. And I want to look at the October edition of the Cynical. It was number 101, the 101st publication or issue of the Cynical. The assistant editor of the Cynical is Raymond's lovely bride, Cassandra Szilard. Let me read you a couple of poems. These are by Colin James. First one's called Reformed Survivalist. Elle searches for her thinking chair containing the ugliest of the three abandoned pups left on our doorstep, but the smartest by far. The pup is wearing black fur, fox or possibly mink. There is a graze on his best side, but it is not so obvious as the gold on his paw, heavy and soft. The slightest trace of lace caresses each fearlessly. We will continue to dress him conservatively until he is well into his recovery. And the second poem is called I Married a Model from an Ocean State Job Lot Flyer. I was arguing with the cashier while holding one hand over an eye, affecting a look. The manager didn't speak pirate, so body language was irrelevant. The rolling hills of Eugenia even would require descriptive winces like overused caterwauls. A t-shirt rack close by began to disassociate. I could tell by the run-on R's and quasi-proletarian P's. Calming down was like laying in a bed of used tissues. Security was provided by the only other male present. Couldn't tell if older or younger, as he didn't fit any prophetical category. I was led away by my future wife, who heard the noise while shooting a fashion layout in the back room. I became immediately compensational and have duly remained so. We have even successfully converted some of her old smocks into blue window curtains and are currently engrossed in other conceptual projects. Now, I'd like to finish up with a reading from Raymond Sillard's Notes from New England. This section is called A Tribute. It was the day the trickster came to Lunatee's Cafe. Long, blonde-haired and blue-eyed, a near-always-present smirk, friendly one. He'd come from somewhere else not long before, but had heard from the traveling troubadour that this place was quite welcoming. The day began early at Lunatee's Cafe, with the door opening and Mr. Bob the barman stepping in. A middle-sized man on the slender side, short pepper-gray hair, a friendly smile for most, if not all, comers. The trickster would come to like him a lot. Pulls on the string attached to the neon sign, telling the joint's name and it being open. Could walk blindfolded through the darkened bar to the back room where he deposits his coat and hat. Finds his apron, old but sturdy, ties it on. Colorous splatter patterns all over it, gift of a friend long ago. Cackles in that back room, his and a mysterious other's. Comes out to the bar room again, still no lights on, walks around turning on machines for a while. Beer taps, jukebox, radio, TV. Briefly back outside in the cool autumn air, linger, linger. Breathe, smile. Plucks his copy of the City Times from the milk crate next to the door. Paperboy gets an extra dollar a week to land it there every day. Pull the makeshift cover over it on wet ones. Finally, with paper, walks to the switch box on the wall behind the bar and flips till the whole place is turned on and ready to go. Radio behind the bar is an old tabletop model. Learned to fix it himself a few years ago. Swap out tubes. Found friendly souls online who loved old machines too and hoarded good parts to sell. Bit of warming up, static, then the usual oldies station. The morning DJ had been bending the format lately, playing songs by that recently passed rocker, Tom Petty, one a day. Said management allowed him one a day. All rock and roll made Mr. Bob think of his friend Rich Americus, who owned Lunatee's Cafe and led the place's house band. noisy children, and Petty, one of Rich's greatest heroes of all. It was a shame to lose Tom Petty. We've lost a lot of beautiful people this year. Writers, musicians, poets. And the best way I know of to remember them is to share their works. Read them over and over. Listen to their songs and sing them in the shower and in the car with your friends at the bar. This is the way we hold on. This is the way we honor people. I'm glad to be part of it. Thank you for being with me today. I look forward to hearing what you've written. I love to read some new things on the radio, and I would like to include something of yours. Send me some ideas for the show if there's a poet you'd like to hear. I'll also consider doing that. Send everything to me at Tamara Miles, SC, at gmail.com. I can't let you get away without sharing a remarkable piece of music by my friend Jenny Nirissel. She sang this version of the Cranberries' Zombie in Irish Gaelic, and she has had 125,000 or more viewers since she put it up, and it's absolutely beautiful. So I'll send you off with this song in honor of Dolores. You've been listening to Where the Most Light Falls with DJ Tamara on Spirit Plants Radio, broadcasting around the world at spiritplantsradio.com. Turn on, tune in, and visit us on the web at spiritplantsradio.com for schedules, playlists, archives, and more.